Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Joe Keating.
And for today's episode, we've got Professor Joe Kane of University College London to talk to us about the Crystal Palace dinosaurs. But before we get to that, how have you been, Joe? What have you been up to?
Yeah, I've been okay. Trucking on with my PhD. So I've been recently pretending to be a molecular biologist and looking at genes and building gene trees and molecular trees for the relationships of vertebrates, which has been challenging and is an ongoing challenge.
Yeah, it sounds it.
It's not, I wouldn't say it's 100% working yet or 10% working yet, but it'll get there.
Good. Today's episode, why have we chosen to go for one with a historical perspective?
Well, yeah, history is a really integral part of science. Whenever you write a scientific paper, you tend to do a history of research. And today's episode, we'll be looking at the Great Exhibition and the Crystal Palace dinosaurs and what they tell us about the early ideas about dinosaurs, evolution, and the development of Earth itself. Really interesting and provide a real insight into the workings of science as a whole.
And Professor Joe Kane is really the perfect person to be talking to about the Great Exhibition. He's Professor of the History and Philosophy of Biology at University College London, and he specialises in the history of natural history, really. But since this is our first dedicated episode on the history of paleontology, we'd like to know what you think. Would you like to hear more episodes like this one? And if so, which historical figures or events would you like discussed? Please let us know in the comments section on our website or on social media.
Absolutely. There's a whole host of other really interesting stories that we can bring to you. So let us know if this is the sort of thing you want to listen to.
So we hope you enjoy this episode.
Thank you for joining us today, Joe. Can you introduce yourself and tell us how you first got interested in your research?
Sure thing. I'm Professor Joe Kane. I'm a professor of history of biology at University College London. I'm a historian of evolutionary biology and paleontology. How did I get started? Well, of course, this is an incredibly interesting field. There's all sorts of great stuff. I started off as an evolutionary biologist and then moved into philosophy of science, and then thought you couldn't do philosophy of science very well without being a historian. So I migrated in that direction. My first bit of research was on the synthesis period of evolutionary biology. So that's the 1930s and 40s, and it's mostly an American story. Then I came to UCL here in London, and nobody wants to hear about American evolutionary biologists here. Everybody wants to hear about the 19th century and Darwin. So that's sort of how I've migrated. And the paleontology has always been with me. And I happened to move to Crystal Palace in South London, which is the home of the Crystal Palace dinosaurs. And so it's just a subject that just draws you in. You cannot visit the park without seeing the dinosaurs. And you cannot see the dinosaurs without getting super excited about them. So that's how I got there.
So you said you started off as an evolutionary biologist and then got interested in philosophy and eventually history. Was there any reason you moved away from research into philosophy and history?
Yeah, sure thing. I got interested in philosophy because I had fantastic philosophy teachers. And you sit in a class and you start thinking those great big thoughts, and you start thinking about the categories we use, like the nature of modern taxonomy. And boy, it just drew me right in, you know, like sweets dangled in front of a kid. And then after a while, it's so obvious to me that philosophy is grounded in the historical period. And so that began my interest in the history of the subject. And of course, you find that paleontologists are incredibly interested in the history of their own field. It's hard, you can't even write about the subject without encountering three centuries of people sort of working on bones of one kind or another. And so it all brilliantly comes together, the philosophy, the science, the history, and the field work, all of which I love immensely.
So you mentioned the Crystal Palace dinosaurs, and we're going to be talking a lot more about the Crystal Palace. But before we do, we need to first talk about the Great Exhibition. So can you tell us a little about this event?
Sure thing. So the Crystal Palace dinosaurs relate to the Great Exhibition. Now, there are two Great Exhibitions in a way. And go back to 1851 and go to central London to Hyde Park. And that's the first Great Exhibition. Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's husband, Prince Albert was a huge enthusiast of science and technology. And he imagined a great exhibition of science and industry for all nations. And to display all that, he commissioned a giant glass house, or what became known as the Crystal Palace. So if you think of a giant glass house, that's really is a Crystal Palace thing. Well, 1851, that great exhibition was designed to be a one-season, one-off event. But it was so popular, when it came to an end, people thought, hey, we could still make money off of this. And they had to get off the site. And so there was a plan hatched to take the glass house apart, shift it to some other place, and then reopen the exhibition. And so in 1854, that migration took place, and a site in South London was purchased, and the Crystal Palace Park opened up. And the dinosaurs live inside the park, but really, if you think of the Crystal Palace Park in 1854, think of an attraction like Disneyland or Disney World or Alton Towers, one of those enormous amusement parks with a big glass house on top of the hill, including all kinds of attractions, and then the park itself, 300 acres of a park, absolutely filled with other kinds of attractions, one of which are the dinosaur sculptures.
What kind of things did they display in the Crystal Palace? What kind of exhibitions were there?
Well, in 1851, it's like a world trade show. It's all sorts of manufacturing things, steam presses, locomotives, that sort of thing. But by the time it gets to Crystal Palace in 1854, it's more like an arts and crafts festival. And you've got a lot of things. You've got the glass house divided into sections, and the sections are certain themes. Like there's an Egyptian section and a Greek section and a Renaissance section, and we as visitors would go there, and it's kind of like walking through any great museum, like the British Museum or the Smithsonian in Washington, where you just go through the sort of the history of civilization, as it were. The glass house is only part of the glass house is really only part of the attraction, the amusement park. But that's roughly what you would see. It would kind of be like going into a museum. In 1854, in Crystal Palace, though, the stuff in the glass house was all fake. It was all copies of stuff that was in great museums elsewhere. And it, you know, to me, it kind of feels like copies. You know, it's like not really worth it. But the Victorians absolutely loved copies, because to them it showed the skill of the copyist. Kind of like nowadays with 3D printing. Boy, if you could make something that's so realistic, you can hold it up as it comes off the 3D printer and show it off, and it kind of shows your skill off. And that's certainly what the Victorians were doing in 1854 in the moved Crystal Palace. They were showing off their ability to copy stuff.
So I can understand the Victorian fascinations with things like steam locomotives, but dinosaurs seems a bit different. What was the public consensus about dinosaurs at the time? Were they really important? Were they megastars?
Dinosaurs were absolutely not on most people's radar in the 1850s. The the notion of a dinosaur it is relatively new. Only the taxonomic categories is defined in the early 1840s. But really, most importantly, there's hardly any specimens out there. What makes the Crystal Palace dinosaur so exciting is it's the first time anybody had tried to make a life-size, three-dimensional reconstruction of these organisms. And there's so few bits of material to work with that, of course, so much of it is conjecture. But going to see them, you think, oh my God, these things are enormous, I mean, bigger than elephants, bigger than, you know, as large as the largest animals that you can imagine. So dinosaurs were definitely not in people's minds, but by the time the displays open in 1854, getting into 1855, the concept of a dinosaur really hits the public imagination. Now, because your listeners will know an awful lot about other organisms besides dinosaurs, I mean, within the Crystal Palace site, there's material from a bunch of different periods. Most importantly, the English discoveries in Lyme Regis and Whitby, the kind of Jurassic marine material, that stuff definitely is on display too. So you get plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs on display. And then you also get what essentially are Ice Age materials. So you get the big Megaloceros, the Irish elk, with those enormous antler spans. And you also get the Megatherium, the giant sloth from South America. So even though we call them the Crystal Palace dinosaurs, there's material on display from a bunch of different geological periods. And when the public went to go see them, dinosaurs are the icing on the cake to this other fantastic stuff. I mean, to me, the most exciting bit are the plesiosaurs. And all you have to do is Google the Crystal Palace dinosaurs and plesiosaur to see the sculptures that are on display. And I just love the curly necks of the sculpture and that sort of thing. And I could well imagine being a kid, you know, 10 years old, staring at these things eye to eye. And frankly, I just focus on the teeth myself, being a monkey. You know, I worry about where the teeth are all the time.
Well, we'll definitely put some pictures of the plesiosaurs up on our website.
Sure.
So who was it that made these amazing models?
Ah, well, you've got basically these are the product of one of the best artists and sculptors of his generation, Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins. So his life basically spans the 19th century. And the best way to think about Waterhouse Hawkins is in the 1830s, he is a well-known illustrator of technical scientific work. And he's so well-known that when Darwin comes back from the Beagle and he gets a commission to write up the notes, the stuff that becomes the Voyage of the Beagle, he wants the very best artist to help him out with the monograph. And the person who comes to help him out is Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins, who's absolutely accurate, very serious about what he does. Plus, he's got that artistic flair. He really can animate things on the page. So when the Crystal Palace Company decide that they're going to do this big event in using the glass house from the Great Exhibition, they basically decide what they want is some kind of big attraction out in the park. They get Waterhouse Hawkins to do it because he's just the top of the field. They're also getting celebrities in all kinds of other areas to do things in the park. But Waterhouse Hawkins stands out as the sculptor of animals that can really do something. And Waterhouse Hawkins, he really wants to do it. He gets incredibly excited about it. A lot of people think that the paleontologist Richard Owen is the guy behind the models, that he's the brains behind the models. And I don't think that's true at all. Owen was consulted. Waterhouse Hawkins did a huge amount of research. He looked at a lot of fossils. He visited museum collections. He looked at a lot of monographs. And he also spoke with some experts, one of which was Richard Owen. Owen helped him out, but it's Waterhouse Hawkins who takes the scraps of bones and he not only creates full skeletons, but he puts flesh on the bones. What I really love to think about with Waterhouse Hawkins and what he actually does for the sculptures is, if you look at a whole sculpture, you've got to ask yourself some questions like, can a dinosaur smile? Or what do the toenails look like? It's all those things that just aren't in the fossil material.
And Waterhouse Hawkins had to make all those decisions. So we look at the dinosaur statues and we think, well, Iguanodon, okay, it looks really awful from the modern perspective. But my gosh, he only had a few bones and he created something that could work as a living organism. That's the real talent of Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins.
So just to backtrack a second there, you mentioned Richard Owen, and that name might be familiar to some of our listeners, but could you just give a brief explanation as to who Richard Owen was?
Sure. Richard Owen was early and mid-19th century, probably the most important British anatomist of his generation. He worked for a while at the Royal College of Surgeons in London, and then he worked for what becomes the Natural History Museum, the British Museum of Natural History. And he's absolutely important in creating the institution that exists today. Theoretically, Richard Owen is hugely influential. He comes up with this idea of an archetype, a basic body plan, which is a beautiful theoretical entity. So if you think of vertebrates and you think in your mind what all vertebrates have, Richard Owen is really important in building that concept for us all, that vertebrates follow a basic body plan. And once you've got that theory, it works and it really helps you with dinosaurs, because as soon as you decide dinosaurs are reptiles or something like reptiles, you can really run with it because you know an awful lot of things about reptiles. Richard Owen is massively important in the expansion of dinosaurs as a concept, and he's massively important in the expansion of reptiles as a concept. Owen also has a reputation for not being a very nice guy, incredibly envious and jealous, possessive of topics. And by and large, he was that way. He was incredibly good, but he had a non-collegiality, I think is the best way to say it, that his reputation hasn't survived very well in the modern world. One thing that your listeners may know about Richard Owen is he was incredibly important in the reconstruction of the MOA, M-O-A, the giant flightless bird in New Zealand. And essentially, Owen just gets a few scraps of bones in the post one day, and he decides that those few scraps of bones are part of a giant flightless bird. And everyone says to him, get out of here. That can't possibly be right. But Owen sticks to his guns, and by golly, he really was right. So anybody who Googles Richard Owen, you're almost bound to get a photograph. You're going to see a painting or a photograph of him near a MOA skeleton or holding onto the bones of a MOA. And this, I think, is Owen speaking to everybody else saying, yeah, I was right, you were wrong. And he's using the photograph as a way to kind of rub it in to his critics.
I always think when I see a portrait of Richard Owen that he looks incredibly sinister.
He kind of does qualify as that Dickensian bad man, you know. But, it, you know, in some ways, it's justified, but in other ways, you know, he really is a fantastic intellect. You know, they used to call him Richard Owen was the Cuvier of Britain, and that was meant to be the huge hat tipping to Georges Cuvier, the French anatomist, and Owen is just about the only person who can hold that up. And I say that with great sadness because at UCL here, we have our very own sort of archetypal theorist from exactly the same period, Robert Grant. And Robert Grant was second class to Richard Owen. And it breaks my heart to say that. My institutional loyalty really, really does come through there.
So moving back to the Crystal Palace dinosaurs after that slight tangent, you mentioned that these sculptures aren't really recognizable as dinosaurs to modern audiences, but were they scientifically accurate at the time?
At the time, definitely yes. And really what's going on is people are trying to figure out what dinosaurs are. They figure they're reptiles, and they're searching around for analogs to connect them. You look at the famous Iguanodon statues, and you can really see this argument playing out. So one view of the Iguanodon is, you know, the name says it all. It's a giant iguana, and there was a lot of evidence for that. If you compare the teeth to other organisms, the thing the teeth are most like are a certain kind of iguana. And so if you just scale up the iguanodon to so the teeth work, you get a giant iguana. But there's two statues of iguanodon in Crystal Palace. The other one shows a competing interpretation, and that's essentially Richard Owen's interpretation, which was dinosaurs were reptiles, but they were structured much more like mammals. And so one of the statues looks like a giant iguana. The other one looks like a giant rhinoceros. And what you see there is the 1850s. You see two scientific views, both valid in some ways, fighting it out. And I think Waterhouse Hawkins, the sculptor, I think he doesn't decide which one's right. I think he gives us one of each. The other ones, the Megalosaurus, the big predatory dinosaur in Crystal Palace. Again, the amount of evidence for that reconstruction, the evidence just there isn't very much. But what they're trying to do is they're just trying to put together something that works. You know, there's a fragment of a jaw. You scale up the jaw. You can look at the kinds of teeth it has, and then you can use your comparative anatomy skills to reason through the rest of the organism. And they end up getting something like if a bear and a crocodile are combined together in a blender, it's sort of that's what you get as a functioning organism. So the dinosaur statues per se in Crystal Palace Park are wildly inaccurate to the modern eye. But I think what we see there is a sculptor really working hard with all the tools he has available at the time to recreate what these things are. The other thing I like about the statues, looking at them three-dimensionally, is the sculptor has got to figure out how do all the parts go together? How does it work as an organism? And it's only when you start making that full size model is when you realize that various bits aren't going to work. A really nice example of that is when the sculptor was working on a Megalosaurus, the giant predatory one, he used a small scale model. And the scale model has some features that were changed when they scaled it up. And broadly, I think that's because, for example, that the model has what is roughly a crocodile head. And I think what happened when they tried to scale it up is it just mechanically wouldn't work. There's just too much weight in the head and not enough to hold it up. And so the sculptor made a decision that the skull needed to change shape in order for the muscles to work to hold the skull up. And it's a great example of how paleontologists work every single day, where reconstruction is necessarily incomplete. You just don't have enough. You very rarely have everything, and you have to make reasoned judgments. Then later evidence comes along and you change your view with new evidence. But what we see in Crystal Palace is just an early stage of that longer process. If you go to Crystal Palace Park and you go looking for bipedal predatory dinosaurs, you're not going to find them. The bipedalism is years away from the reconstructions. But nevertheless, it's pretty cool to see how they're trying to make them work.
So one of the most obvious things that you notice mm-hmm. about the iguanodon, for example, is that it's got its a rhino horn on its nose. Was yes. there any story as to why that is?
Yes, there is. There's always the myth is that, well, they're putting this together and they had a spare part, so they just plonked it on the nose. But there, really the way it worked was when Gideon Mantell, who is the person who is identified with iguanodon, when he's trying to figure out what this thing is, he's got the tooth, and he goes to a comparative anatomy collection and he asks the curator, I have this tooth, what is it like in your collection? And the keeper brings out an iguana, and the teeth really match extremely well, hence the name iguanodon. But it just so happens that iguana also has a horn on its nose. And it just happens to be that. And so at the end of the day, the idea that this organism does have a horned nose draws directly out of that analogy to the comparative anatomy collection.
So I was always told that it was the thumb spike that they didn't know what to do with. But is that a myth?
It is a myth that they didn't know what to do with it. It is in fact a thumb spike, and so later on, when more fossil material is found, basically in the 1860s and 70s, it's pretty clear that it has nothing to do with the nose, and it has a lot to do with the hand. But that's a decade off, and it basically just doesn't get fixed because Waterhouse Hawkins goes on to do other things. But yeah, it's funny how these myths and folktales get told and retold and retold. I mean, I used to think, yeah, you just have a spare part, drop it on there somewhere, make it fit. Everybody has models that they tried to build at one time or another, jigsaw puzzles where they tried to jam something in just to make it work. But again, what's great about paleo is it's so evidence-based, and as you find new material, you shift things around. I love to point out, well, you don't really need to point out the nose spike to kids. They all see it. But then you ask them, about science and how new evidence changes scientific views. And then the nose spike goes from being something that's wrong to being something that's kind of wrong for the right reason, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. So as you mentioned before, there's not only dinosaurs, but mammals and all other manner of extinct animals sculpted in the park. Are they all mixed together or are they separated into groups or ages?
That's an excellent question. One of the things that one reason I encourage people to visit the park is to see the three-dimensional landscape. And basically what you've got is over 30 statues laid out in a corner of the park. They're laid out according to their appearance in the geological time scale. And so they're not thrown down at random. And what's absolutely fascinating, and scholars have been picking this up in the last couple of years, absolutely fascinating about, why would you do that? Well, they're doing it because if you lay things out in terms of time, then you can ask yourself about pattern. And basically what you've got is to use Victorian terms, the primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary epochs, so 1, 2, 3, 4. And if you organize the material according to where they appear in the geological column, walking through the display, you're walking through time. And the Victorians were absolutely obsessed with progress and sequence and things like that. And so I think what's happening is it's really an open question about what is the pattern to the history of life. In fact, the way I like to talk about it is, if you think of the layers of the rock as chapters of a book, the question for a visitor would be, so what's the relationship of the chapters? Are we dealing with a set of essays that are separate? They just happen to be thrown into the same book? Or are we dealing with a novel where one chapter follows from the previous one, and there's something like a plot building up or a narrative building up going through? So Victorian visitors would be asking themselves, what is the history of life? What is the story to the history of life? Is it just a bunch of epochs separated, or is there a direction to things? In fact, I think, there are four geological units within the statues of the dinosaurs. I actually think there's five in the park, because I think primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then the modern five is actually the Crystal Palace glass house itself. In other words, it's humanity, it's us. So yes, of course, the story is a story of progress. I think they're trying to tell us that from the beginning of life, since when animals first started walking on land, they develop in a particular direction. They go from the marine reptiles to the land reptiles to the land mammals to humanity, and that was supposed to be a really good story for the Victorians.
So Walter House Hawkins was a contemporary of Charles Darwin.
Yes.
When the park was opened, had Darwin yet published his Origin of Species?
Ah, right. So the park opens in 1854, and that's when the dinosaurs go on display. The Origin of Species is published in 1859, so 5 years later. And you know what drives me absolutely mad as a historian is I know Charles Darwin was at the opening of the Crystal Palace in 1854. I know he was there. Emma Darwin, his wife, made him go because she wanted to go. And we absolutely know he was inside the glass house, but I can find no evidence whatsoever of Darwin going to see the dinosaurs. He must have, I think. He must
surely
have.
Surely.
Because the connection and with Owen and with Darwin and Owen were reasonably good friends early in their careers, and then they split later on. So in the 1850s, they really were not very good friends. But nevertheless, it'd be really hard for Darwin not to want to go. But he never writes about it. He never comments about it. The guy writes about everything that he encounters, it seems. But he doesn't write about this. So I frankly just have to say I don't know if he ever saw the dinosaurs. That said, there's a way to think about the dinosaurs in a way that tells us a story of development that doesn't necessarily tell us a story about natural selection and evolution. There's an awful lot of people in the middle part of the 19th century we know now who were thinking about evolution, but a lot of them were thinking about it in terms of development, like the way, say, an infant develops into an adult, the idea that there's just a natural transformation. And what Darwin does is he adds natural selection on there to make the process quite a bit more random and quite a bit less directional than most other sort of evolutionists or developmentalists would have been. And that's absolutely fascinating. So Darwin is unusual for part of his thinking about evolution, but certainly not for all of it. And folks who visited the statues in Crystal Palace, the academics certainly would have been familiar with this idea of the long-term development of life on Earth. The real question for them is why? Why does the history of the world exist this way? I mean, what on earth is going on here? You know, if the world was made for humanity, why not just make it for humanity and not give it a backstory? It doesn't need to have this long developmental story to have humans work. And so that's the scratch your head, wonder, you know, what is the big plan here sort of problem of the sort of theologically minded or cosmologically minded scientists in the 1850s. Why have this long story? Why not just start with humans? And Darwin, of course, is participating in that in that conversation, but he certainly is not the only one.
We can't talk about the Crystal Palace without talking about the famous dinosaur dinner. So could you tell us a little bit about this unusual event?
Oh yeah, everybody's seen that picture of the dinner in the Iguanodon, right? So move to 1854. The opening of the Crystal Palace is in June of 1854. But for 6 months before that, there'd been advanced publicity for the park, for the glass house, for everything. And so the PR machine of the company that runs the park is really going in full gear. And Waterhouse Hawkins cooks up an idea for a public relations stunt. And that is on New Year's Eve, as 1853 turns into 1854, what he's going to do is he's going to bring some journalists to the dinosaur statues, going to feed them a fancy dinner of the most exotic animals, and then he's going to get them really, really drunk. And his hope is very shortly thereafter, they're going to write a great story about the statues. And that's essentially what happens. And so he cooks up this really he orders up this really fancy meal. And then he plies everybody with an awful lot of drink. And then there's a bunch of toasts and singing and dancing and men running about in madness on New Year's Eve. And that's the dinner and the dinosaurs, basically. And it's the image that gets circulated quite a bit of the banquet taking place inside the Iguanodon. It's just a small part of what essentially is a press stunt to get attention. And boy, he handled his press relations pretty well, I think we have to say, because, you know, what is it, 160 years later, we're still talking about it.
So who was invited to the dinner?
A couple of sets of people. So a couple of famous scientists, and scientists who were also serving as consultants elsewhere in the Crystal Palace Park, but mostly journalists and people who could control publicity. And basically all the newspaper reporters, periodical reporters around. Waterhouse Hawkins knew what was going to happen, or at least he knew what he had in mind, because he drew a he drew an image of the dinner long before the dinner actually took place. And so basically the plan was, you know, this is what I'm going to do. And it's easy to forget that the etching that we have is not a photograph. A lot of people think it is a photograph. And so they spend time trying to figure out just how many people sat inside the Iguanodon and all that based on that image. But it's Waterhouse Hawkins' fanciful reconstruction of what he wanted to have happen, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
It basically boils down to a bunch of lads, New Year's Eve, a lot of drink, a lot of good food, and they had a pretty good time. That's the best way to say it.
So when the park eventually opened, was it a success?
It was a short-term success. The biggest problem with any kind of amusement park like that is not getting people to go, but getting people to go back. And so the repeat business was the biggest problem. And just like most of your listeners will say, you know, oh yeah, there's that amusement park. I haven't been there for years, or the zoo or the museum. Yeah, I went there as a kid, but I've never gone back. And the Crystal Palace needed people to return. Darwin is a really good example of this, because in order to get there on the opening day, he had to buy a season ticket. So he had to buy a sort of all year pass. And the correspondence shows that he tried to use that pass a lot, an absolute lot, getting his kids to go, getting his friends to go, you know, come on, meet me down at the Crystal Palace. But all that visiting of the Crystal Palace happens for a year, and then Darwin seems never to have gone back. It's sort of that he blew his interest in it straight away. And that kind of story is a story that that it seems to be a very common one for Crystal Palace. And it what happens is they have lots of financial problems as the decades move on. Maintenance is really expensive. People get kind of bored with the displays. They have to keep adding new rides and new attractions and new events. And by the turn of the century, so, you know, 50 years later, the palace is looking pretty run down, pretty tired, and in need of a makeover.
So how about Waterhouse Hawkins? What did he do after the park opened?
Ah, no, that's great. The way we remember Waterhouse Hawkins is this is the biggest event in his whole life, that creating these statues. Well, it's not really true. First of all, 1854, when the park opens up, he's not done yet. He still has a bunch of statues he wants to make. So for a few years, he's trying to keep that happening inside the park. And the company who owns the park stop him. In fact, they stop him just as he's trying to create a giant mammoth on one of the islands. And he basically has the footings for the legs poured. And they say, look, stop spending money. You know, the attraction is good enough for our purposes. Now move on. Waterhouse Hawkins, after that, he goes back into the artistic trade, as a jobbing artist for natural history and other things. In the 1860s, he basically gets the idea that he can repeat what happens in Crystal Palace Park, and he's going to try to sell it to somebody else. And he goes to New York City, and he convinces people there that they basically need a dinosaur park in Central Park. And that project gets underway. And of course, by then, some of the great American discoveries have started to be made. And so new things are added to the old set of displays in New York City. That sculpture park never happens, because for some reason, we're not quite sure why, for some reason his studio gets absolutely trashed and destroyed by vandals at a crucial moment. And basically everything is destroyed. All the material that he brought from Britain, all the new stuff that he was putting together, all the plans, all that stuff completely trashed. And that's kind of the end of that story. So the great second edition of the dinosaur park just didn't happen because of this.
I heard probably another myth that all those broken statues are buried somewhere under Central Park.
Oh yeah, that it is a to be honest, it's either a myth or it isn't. I really don't. I mean, we know exactly where the studio was because it's on the maps, and it is said even at the time that the material was buried. And a couple of people have tried to find it. I mean, essentially, it's near where the American Museum of Natural History is now, and so some people have wandered over to Central Park to sort of kick around a few rocks to see if they can discover it. But frankly, I think what happened was, you know, none of this stuff is original fossil material, and a lot of it is concrete block, and it doesn't take a lot to destroy it in such a way that we're never going to find it. We will never recognize it as what it is, just a pile of rubble, I'm afraid. And that's so sad. Waterhouse Hawkins, at that point, I mean, you have to remember, this guy doesn't have a job. He's going from contract to contract to contract. And so he is not living the high life. And that's the worst part about the destruction of that material is it's not that, you know, 100 years later, we don't have it. You know, that's sad. But the poor guy, he loses his job. He loses his livelihood. And he is stuck. You know, he really is in trouble when it comes to how he's going to meet his own bills at that point.
So that was the end of Waterhouse Hawkins' dinosaur building.
Roughly. And that is such a shame. And also, the intellectually the real shame is that American material is really looking exciting. It's dinosaurs on a scale that, of course, nowadays we know very well. It is stuff that we just simply don't know in England. And so Waterhouse Hawkins' attempt to reconstruct them, I think that would have been game changing insofar as the way the broad public was thinking about dinosaurs. Because it's not really until, say, the 1920s that a new concept of dinosaurs gets into the public imagination. You know, the sort of Brontosaurus, Sinclair Oil style dinosaur. It's not until the 1920s that gets into the public consciousness, and that's really through film, like films like The Lost World, and then in the 1930s, films like King Kong. You know, you start to see these relics from the deep past, and I think that's partly because there just aren't things for people to focus their attention on. The sculptures that would have been in Central Park in New York City, I think they would have focused the American imagination in the same way that the sculptures in Crystal Palace do for the English imagination.
So yeah, moving back across the mm-hmm. Atlantic, back to the yes. Crystal Palace.
Yeah,
what became of the Crystal Palace and its dinosaurs?
Ah, right. Well, the Crystal Palace is a going concern as an amusement park up until the Great War, and then after that, it just struggles to do anything. Some sort of national fairs and celebrations take place in Crystal Palace Park, but basically, it's dead as an attraction. The glasshouse burns down in the 1930s, and that's the absolute end of the park. The dinosaurs, basically, they survive by neglect. They are on little islands that are relatively inaccessible. You kind of have to work to get there. And the statues remain okay. They start to decay, but every once in a while, somebody tries to fix them up a little bit. The dinosaur statues are still there. And of course, that's the big enterprise of the moment. There was a really big effort. There was a really big effort around the year 2000 to reconstruct the dinosaur statues, and they did a fantastic job. But the year 2000 was a long time ago, I'm sad to say. And 15 years or so ago, it's been a long time, and there has not been much significant work on them since. So if you go there today as in today, a common comment is, boy, they look a bit worn down. They need some help. And that's, of course, why we started the Friends of the Crystal Palace Dinosaurs. The goal being to lobby for conservation and to do everything that we can to make sure that the statues are preserved in their original sort of configuration.
Absolutely. So would you encourage anyone around London to go and visit the dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Look, if you live in London, it's easy. Just get on the Overground or get on the train and go to Crystal Palace Park. It just couldn't be easier. If you want to ride the buses go straight there. If you're from further away, basically when you come to visit London, it's a half an hour train ride south to Crystal Palace. And then it's a lovely time in the park. You can see the statues. You can see the geological landscape, so you can see them laid out in their original form. But also the park is a huge natural park. It's one of the great green spaces of London. There are some traces of the original Crystal Palace. There are some Sphinx statues. There's a bunch of other pieces of the original park. Plus you're out in the great park. So come to London on a sunny day.
It's near the Horniman Museum as well, which is a great museum.
Ah, indeed, right. Yes, that's the lovely you call it a local museum, and it's massively unfair to say that. But the Horniman is a great sort of Edwardian natural history museum, and it includes some absolutely fantastic natural history material. It also has some really old displays of the way people used to present evolution, which is really fascinating from a historian's point of view.
So what do you think the legacy of the Crystal Palace and its dinosaurs has been?
The legacy of the dinosaurs, what I think is important there is it shows us how science works. That it's not about right or wrong. It's about hypothesis creation and about fact testing. So as new data gets found, we reflect against what we think, and we change our views. The dinosaurs are great sculpture, and they're exciting for what they were. But far more importantly, when you go there now, it's the fact that we've moved so far away from them. That's the thing to celebrate. The fact that we look at the statues and say they're wrong, boy, that really reminds us that science is a self-correcting process. We don't have everything right, but 10 years from now, we're going to be smarter than we are today, and that's a good thing.
Well, thank you, Professor Joe Kane. That was a great interview, and I definitely learned something.
Well, thanks very much, and don't forget to go to Crystal Palace.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.